Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. A number of Broward County schools are facing a serious drop in student enrollment. Earlier this week, there was a school board meeting to consider proposals that combine multiple schools in the southern part of the county. Now, it comes as school board members and parents are raising questions about thousands of work orders that are yet to be filled by district schools throughout the county. Scott Travis is the education reporter for the Sun Sentinel. He joins us now to discuss this. Scott, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So how big of a drop in enrollment are we talking about, Scott?
Well, actually, probably in the past year, it's been over 3,000 students. And it had been a little bit more stable in the past few years. But this year, it got pretty dramatic. But if you look over time, because of the big impact the charter schools have had in the county, especially in the south part of the county, then it's been the elementary schools in Broward County have lost about 20,000 students in the past 15 years, and the middle schools have lost about 10,000. High school has been a little bit more stable because it's harder for charter schools to open high schools because they're just so expensive to run because of all the activities that they have, like band, athletics, etc.
So it's charter schools and private schools that's the reason for the drop.
Yeah, charter schools would probably be the biggest impact. Obviously, there are private schools, and there's more opportunities for parents to have vouchers as well, too. So that's another factor. But I think charter schools is by far the biggest factor.
So what have you heard from parents about why they want to move their kids out of the traditional public school into the charter school program?
Generally, what we hear is they feel like either the academics are not satisfactory at the school or safety is a concern, or both. Those are probably the two biggest. Another factor we hear, too, especially in Broward County, is the condition of facilities. They have a lot of very deteriorating schools in Broward County that they've been promising to fix for years, and they even got the 2014 bond referendum to fix those, and they're just way, way behind on those. I mean, in 5 years, they've finished 9 schools so far, and they have about 225 to go. So they're not making a ton of progress in that regard. So those have been some of the big factors that we're hearing. The other thing is that the K-8 model has been really popular in charter schools. Most of the successful charter schools in South Florida have used that, where they have kids in kindergarten through 8th grade. Middle schools have always been, or at least in the past 20 years or so, have been struggling, and a lot of parents feel like they're not safe and that it's an awkward time for kids. They're not as cute as they were in elementary school, and they're not as mature as they're going to be in high school. So it's and a lot of charter schools have been able to determine that doing a K-8 model has been very successful. So Broward Schools has been trying to replicate that, and they've done it with mixed results. Some of them have done okay, and some of them, there's really no improvement there.
You know, so are we talking about public schools in Broward County that would have to close down? Because, I mean, the talk is possibly consolidating some campuses, right?
That's what the discussion was, but they had a meeting on Tuesday to discuss this, and there just did not seem to be much community support for consolidating schools. So it's still unclear what's going to happen. There are three proposals that are out there for consolidating. And in all three cases, the community said, we don't like this idea. We think, you know, the elementary school parents, a lot of them were concerned that their kids would be going to school with older kids, and that could be dangerous for them. Some of the alumni at Attucks Middle School, which was, there's a proposal to merge that with Bethune Elementary. They feel like that that's going to take away from the legacy and the great history of their middle school. So there's been concern on both sides. So basically what the school district decided is they ruled out at least two possible mergers of where they're going to take an elementary and a middle school and combine them into one. Driftwood Elementary and Driftwood Middle was another one where they said the community seems to be opposed to this. Everybody who came out to speak about it basically said, we don't like this idea, especially the elementary parents that seemed to voice concerns about being there with middle school kids. And they also thought that it'd create traffic concerns because you're going to have one start time and one end time, and everyone would be there at the same time.
And
so
the other thing too is this. I mean, if your enrollment is dropping, you're having fewer kids at the school, then you've got a lot more space that's not being used. Or I mean, am I just guessing at that?
No, you're absolutely right. And that's another, you know, controversial thing is closing a school. They could combine a lot of schools, and but it's going to be very disruptive. Nobody wants to see their own school closed. So that's one of the more popular proposals that hasn't been approved yet, but it's still in the running, is Hollywood Central Elementary would expand to become a K-8 school. The issue there is they don't have any proposal to do anything to any other middle school to offset whatever kids are going to be getting there. If all the kids come from charter schools, which the district would like, then no problem for them. But if they're going to be coming from nearby Olson Middle School, which has already been struggling with declining enrollment, it's just going to further cause it to dwindle, and you're going to start having schools that are 30-40% occupied, and it just doesn't seem like a sustainable method to do things in the long run.
And so you're talking about moving kids around. What about the teachers? What happens to them?
Well, it just depends on enrollment. Obviously, if your enrollment goes down, then you need fewer teachers. And chances are teachers would not lose their jobs because of the fact that there's a teacher shortage in the state, and they have a hard enough time just hiring new ones to fill all the demand for people who leave.
So they'd be relocated.
Yeah, they'd be relocated.
I'm talking with Sun Sentinel Education reporter Scott Travis. Again, multiple considerations right now for the possibility of consolidating district schools, primarily in the South Broward County area, because enrollment has been dropping. As we found out, a lot more parents are now moving their kids to charter schools. Scott, beyond low enrollment, I mean, district schools are also facing major infrastructure challenges, as you've reported over the years. You reported thousands of work orders for school improvements have remained opened. Why? Why has it taken so long?
Yeah, they have some real challenges in their maintenance department. Basically, they cut funding from that department during the recession, and then they never restored it. And the idea was that they were going to have this $800 million bond program that was going to solve all of the deferred maintenance issues in the county. Or it wasn't going to solve all of them, but it was at least going to make a dent. But they've been so far behind there that they haven't been able to make the real progress that they need to make sure that schools have sturdy roofs and that air conditioners are going to be fixed for the long term. So all they've really been able to do is get to the emergencies. So lots of stuff that is not life or death ends up just going unfilled and, you know, for a long time.
Right. But Broward schools are paying significantly more for work orders compared to other school districts. What were school administrators' justification for these higher costs for these projects? What did they say?
The only thing we've heard so far from them is that they're studying the issue and that the calculations that were made on that particular study were not apples to apples, that they do not calculate the cost of a work order in Broward County exactly the way they may in other school districts. Whether that's true, I don't know. That hasn't been verified.
Is there an issue of mismanagement of funds? Any kind of corruption?
Well, there's been a supervisor, a grounds and custodial supervisor, that just a month or so ago was federally indicted on bribery charges. That he was taking money from vendors, and, you know, as kickbacks. So they actually got a vendor to wear a tape recorder and catch him in the act. So they got him up to, at least allegedly, that's what it says according to the report. But it's after he accepted $5,000 worth of bribes, and that was enough to file federal bribery charges.
What have we heard from the superintendent, from Robert Runcie, about all of this? I mean, the high cost of the infrastructure, and again, why it's taken so long. What has he said about it?
Well, he doesn't usually do interviews with me very often anymore. So basically what I hear from him is usually from school meetings, school board meetings. I did talk to him a little bit the other day after the meeting, and he said that they were going to be basically looking into these issues and finding out why there were certain anomalies in certain areas, why the school district was paying a lot for certain areas. And I mean, they're doing things like the maintenance department was paying to repair city sidewalks when that's not even the function of a school district. That's the function of a municipality.
And a reminder to us all here is that voters approved an $800 million bond for school developments back in 2014. I mean, how much of that money has been spent on infrastructure and development?
Well, I did a story at the five-year anniversary in November, and at that point, it had been 5 years and eight schools that were completed, and they still had about 226 or 227 to go. So it's extremely slow progress going on there. It's turned out to be far more difficult than they anticipated. They didn't really plan well for it ahead of time to make sure that they had everything in place to get this work done. A lot of the work was very complicated because it wasn't just building new schools. It was renovating very old schools that had years and years of deferred maintenance. Yeah. And it just turned out to be a much bigger challenge than what they anticipated.
What's next when it comes, we'll come back to this issue of consolidation again, of how do we deal with campuses that are losing students? What's coming up next on that?
So I think they're going to continue to explore options. And I think consolidating schools is going to continue to be on the table. I think one of the biggest concerns that the school district has regarding that, though, is that if you close a school, then state law allows a charter school to be able to pretty easily take over that campus if it's available. So the school district doesn't want to just leave a campus completely empty, because then a charter school might be able to get it. So they're going to continue to try to do things to add more programs. They're adding a Cambridge program to a bunch of schools, which is a international program affiliated with Cambridge University that provides college level classes to kids. So that's been very successful at Fort Lauderdale High and Piper High and some others. So they're going to try to duplicate that around other high schools and even have feeder programs at middle schools. So they hope that will attract more kids, and they're adding a military academy at a new school and doing some other things that they hope will bring kids to their schools.
We will keep an eye on that, as you are as well. Scott Travis, educational reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Super Bowl is this Sunday, and it has brought all kinds of festivities and economic activity to South Florida. But most of the NFL-sanctioned events and parties are in the city of Miami, Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale. None of them are in Miami Gardens, and that's the city that's actually hosting the game. Is the city losing out on a lot of money? We're joined now by Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Mayor Gilbert, thank you so much for the time today.
Good morning. How are you all today?
We're good, but here's the thing. I want to know, what does it mean to you and the residents of Miami Gardens to have the Super Bowl right there in your neighborhood?
We're always happy to host the Super Bowl. We understand that when the Super Bowl comes to South Florida, it's not actually coming to South Florida. It's coming to Miami Gardens, which is in South Florida. And we appreciate the fact that the eyes of the world will be on Miami Gardens. And we also appreciate the fact that we're part of a larger tourism ecosystem. And that kind of makes our bid attractive in some respects. So we understand all of that.
But, you know, when you watch a game, whether it's the Super Bowl or any Dolphins game, you know, every time the network shows aerial footage of downtown Miami or South Beach, never of Miami Gardens. So Miami's getting a lot of love, but you're not.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know that over time we've had the argument and we've had the struggle, you know, because the city's relatively new. And so now when they air the games from Hard Rock Stadium, they say Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens, it is a process. And it is a process. You hear, you know, people saying they're going to South Beach. They're not really going to South Beach to play a Super Bowl. I don't know anywhere where they could play a South Beach, a Super Bowl game or a football game on South Beach, unless they're just going to play in the sand. But we understand that that's part of the education. That's part of the maturation of us as a community. Miami Gardens is relatively new. So what we have to do as a city and as a community is recondition our anticipation and our execution of these events so that it actually helps in all parts of the community and not just the picture, which is the beach, and the brand, which is Miami.
You know, every time you have a Super Bowl, you have a lot of NFL-sanctioned events and parties. Again, as I mentioned, they're in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, a lot of other places. Why not in Miami Gardens? Or did you have conversations with the NFL about trying to get them to have some of those events in your city?
Well, we don't have NFL-sanctioned events in Fort Lauderdale, I believe. I believe that the agreement with South Florida, the Miami Host Committee, was that it would all be in Miami-Dade County.
Okay.
So I think that, yeah, I don't think it's in Fort Lauderdale anymore. We had those conversations, and that's not something they were looking to do this time. So what we did was we partnered with some folks from some people, Ted Lucas, Melvin Bratton, the city partnered with them to have Superfest Miami and Miami Gardens. And we have national stars like Migos and Cardi B and Chris Brown and those folks coming out. Not just something for our residents to do, but what we found is people from all across America, people who are visiting South Florida, are coming to it also. So it's one of those things that if you really want something done and you want to prove to someone that it really can be done well, you do it yourself. And so we're doing it ourselves right now.
Yeah. So you're talking about, again, you Superfest. It's an event that the city is putting on. So you're paying for that. So the NFL is not part of it in any way. I mean,
absolutely not. It's not a sanctioned event by the NFL, but it is sanctioned by the city. And we're not just paying for it. We're partnering with it. So it's really a cool partnership because Ted Lucas, Melvin Bratton, Miami-born, Miami-bred folks who understand what the Super Bowl means to not just South Florida but Miami Gardens and the larger Black community in South Florida. They said, hey, we want to do this, and they came to the city. And so we've been working with them, and it's turning out well.
Do you see any of the money, though, from the Super Bowl, whether it's in hotels, restaurants? I mean, are people coming and spending money in your city?
People are coming and spending money in some of our restaurants. We don't really have hotels like that right now. So what we've been trying to do is, and we've done a pretty good job of it, is getting more economic development. So you see restaurants like the Lickin, which will be really packed, and Topgolf, which will be really packed, and Lorna's, which will be really packed. Those things will be happening, and people will be spending that type of money in Miami Gardens at our restaurants. But when people say cities don't see money during the Super Bowl, cities don't see money during the Super Bowl. We pay for the infrastructure. We get everything right. It's the businesses and the people that the businesses employ. And so we have some of those businesses, but we're trying to build out a capacity to have more of them. We need more restaurants. We need first-class hotels in Miami Gardens. And that's part of the economic development push that we've been going through as a city. It's part of our growth.
You know, if you would say anything, there's a plus, because if you are going to host these events and when the NFL comes into town, they expect a lot. There's a lot you'd have to put up front for them to even consider you. And then, of course, all the extra security. So, I mean, that's a plus, right? Can you look at it that way, that you don't have that extra cost?
Well, it would be not just not having the extra cost, but not having the extra burden of having all of that infrastructure shut off for the entire week. When you build out stuff like the fan zones and the NFL experiences and things like that, you're undergoing a massive undertaking that may or may not be expensive. What it will do is alter daily life. And I think for extended period of time, and I think one of the things that people probably miss is that Miami Gardens is largely a residential community. Even the stadium sits in a residential area, basically. So it's having that type of time and space locked up, we can do it. And if called upon, we would do it. But it would be an inconvenience to some of the residents.
You know, do football games, do events at Hard Rock, are they a disruption to the residents, you know, because you have all that extra traffic for an event?
There's extra traffic. We work, there's definitely extra traffic, and it definitely changes how you move about the city during games and during concerts and stuff like that. What we try to do is work with the Miami Dolphins and the stadium operations to actually get people in and out of the community as quickly as possible. And then to work with the officers, some of them stay so that they can allow for the understanding that while we understand people want to get to the games and get out of the games, people also want to get to their houses and get out of their houses. And so one should not overly burden the other. And so that's always a kind of moving scale that depending on the event. But we try continuously to tinker with it because we understand that we don't want our residents to bear unnecessary burdens of not being able to enjoy their life because of events.
You know, for you as a mayor, I mean, what do you want to get out of the Super Bowl? What do you hope it's going to do to help you and to help the city?
Well, I hope that one of the things that we always struggle with is narratives. And a lot of times when people think about Miami Gardens, they might not think about the most positive things. I want the eyes of the world to be on Miami Gardens on February 2nd. I want the Super Bowl to be champion and champions to be crowned in Miami Gardens. And while I appreciate we're part of this larger ecosystem, they're not winning a championship on the beach or on Brickell. They're winning it in Hard Rock Stadium, which is in Miami Gardens. So we are part of that ecosystem, but we are a unique and distinct part of that ecosystem. And a seminal part, a part that can't be replaced.
Well, let me.
I want people to really understand that this is where the game is played, and these are the people that are welcoming the world into their home to view the Super Bowl.
But as you said, so let me push back a little bit here. As you said, the championship is being played, obviously, at Hard Rock Stadium, which is in Miami Gardens. But, you know, I'm thinking as a TV producer, and I want shots that I'm going to show to the world. I mean, I don't want residential shots. I want shots of South Beach. I want the shots of downtown, you know, on the water. I want the big city skyline. And any game you watch, it's always going to be shots of the city, because there are a lot of stadiums that are not in their cities anyway, but it's always about the city. So, I mean, again, how are you as the mayor going to bring that attention on February 2nd to your city?
Well, I'm not even sure you're pushing back, because I'm not sure that we're disagreeing. I don't think that you have to, it has to be either or. You can do cutaways of the beach because we want to attract people to South Florida. When people come to South Florida, they stay in hotels and they fly into the airport and they sail out of the seaport and they eat at restaurants. That benefits everyone. It benefits all of us because our economy is so predicated on tourism. So that's not a benefit that's lost on our residents. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't have those things. I'm saying you don't necessarily have to only have those things. And most importantly, when you are showing the Super Bowl, when you are showing the stadium, you show the stadium, and the stadium is in Miami Gardens. You look, the beach is in Miami Beach. Brickell is in the city of Miami. The stadium is in Miami Gardens. And so we understand that we're part of something larger. And in some respect, that's how we get Super Bowls. Not by saying, hey, you're going to come and play this game in Miami Gardens. But, hey, we have this wonderful stadium in Miami Gardens, the Hard Rock Stadium. And we have all these hotel rooms scattered throughout Miami-Dade County. And we have this area that we can build out that would be very scenic. And it helps us because this is advertising that we can't buy as a community, not just as Miami Gardens, but as a community. So we're showing the rest of the world when they're freezing or they're wet or they're someplace where the weather is not comfortable. We're showing them someplace, hopefully, that's beautiful and comfortable. And them visiting us actually doesn't just help Miami Gardens. It helps our entire tourism ecosystem.
Mayor Gilbert, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate it. And enjoy the weekend's festivities.
All right. Thank you.
And again, we've been talking with Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Again, Miami hosting the Super Bowl for the 11th time. No other city has done that. The game is this Sunday. Well, still to come, we look at the controversy surrounding a highway stretching across South Florida. That's coming up next.
We're funded by members and by Jackie Abraham Jewelers, dedicated to helping you convert your diamonds, gemstones, and jewelry into liquidity discreetly and securely. With over 25 years' experience in Bay Harbor Islands. More at JackieAbraham.com, where confidence is precious.
You can enjoy the sounds of Kiba and the Usual Suspects at a romantic outdoor concert under the stars this Valentine's Day, Friday, February 14th, at Deering Estate. More information and tickets at DeeringEstate.org.
Miami Motel Stories, the critically acclaimed immersive theater experience, is back. You can get your key and discover the history of North Beach through the decades, opening February 6th. Tickets at MiamiMotelStories.com, produced by Juggernaut Theater Company.
Miami. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. One of the stories we're following is about the debate over a symbol of the old Southern Confederacy. We're talking about the name of Dixie Highway. It's a road that dates back years after the Civil War. It was a way to connect a lot of the Southern states. But the name Dixie is linked to the Confederacy and, of course, to slavery. The road's name has always been a painful reminder for some of that history. Broward County Mayor Dale V.C. Holness is black, and he wants people to understand how that name impacts his community.
We knew for a long time the connotation of Dixie as it pertains to the black community, slavery, and the bad treatment that blacks got throughout this country over time. And again, Dixie, it goes back to Dixie more or less as a symbol in terms of name. It's tied to that oppression.
Numerous cities across South Florida are now debating changing the name within their municipalities, which they're allowed to do. In Miami-Dade County, Commissioner Dennis Moss has proposed naming the road after Harriet Tubman, the American abolitionist linked to the Underground Railroad. And we've heard from some of you on this issue. Dado from Palm Beach Gardens thinks the name should change. He told us, every generation of people that live in this geographic area needs to govern in the best way it reflects their culture and the needs of the locals. The fact that this name is still used and not changed during the Civil Rights Movement is mind-numbing. Daryl, a Florida native, says that the name should not be changed. She told us, changing a name does not change anything. It is only a socialistic tool to erase history. Share with us your thoughts on the name of Dixie Highway. What should happen to it? Do you think the name should change? What would you call it instead? Text the word HELLO to 305-602-2646. Again, the word HELLO, one word, to 305-602-2646. The deadline to text in your responses is Sunday, February 3rd at 6 a.m. Well, for this month's Sundial Book Club selection, we have been reading Mothers of Sparta by Fort Lauderdale author Dawn Davies. Her story takes readers on a journey across the country and the state of Florida as she details her life raising children in poverty and at times as a single mom. Raising an autistic son as a single mother proves to be one of the greatest challenges that Dawn faces. And after writing her memoir, she heard from mothers around the country that shared similar experiences. For our book club panel conversation, we sat down with Dr. Diane Adrian. She's the Associate Director of the University of Miami and Nova Southeastern University Center for Autism and Related Disabilities. She explained the resources available to parents of special needs children.
So many parents know their child's on the spectrum before they enroll in school. If they've had concerns and brought them to a neurologist or someone, they may have already received a diagnosis. But, you know, autism is a broad spectrum, so there are certainly a lot of children who maybe their problems aren't recognized until they're already attending school.
And what's the responsibility of a school? I mean, does the school do any testing itself? Does it have to know where the child is if in case a parent is not sure?
When a child is between the ages of 3 to 5 and the parent has a concern, the FIDLRS, the Florida Diagnostic and Learning Resource Services, is any parent can arrange with FIDLRS for a free evaluation to see if their child qualifies for special education services. So between the ages of 3 and 5, school districts are under a mandate, you know, national law that says they should be looking in their community and basically assess any child where there's a concern that the child might have special needs and might need special services. Once a child turns 5, it's a bit different. When a child turns 5 and or older and they're having difficulty in school, the school can convene a meeting with the parents and anybody else the parent wants to bring. And if they're noticing difficulties, they can discuss those difficulties. But first, they won't immediately refer for testing because now they're under a special ed law that says that they shouldn't over-identify children for special needs. What they should do first is try to do what they call response to intervention to put some strategies in place to address the problems and see if that resolves the child's difficulties in class.
How do the schools determine the courses for special needs? The spectrum is so wide.
First of all, the parents are an integral part of the team. It's not just school personnel. They're a key part of the team as well to look at what are the child's needs. First, the school system, the whole team will decide if the child's eligible for some special ed services. Next, they'll write an individualized educational plan. And after that's written, then the team can discuss what placement options are available to where can the IEP be implemented successfully. And by law, the teams are supposed to look at the least restrictive environment where they think the child can be successful and have the amount of supports they need or the amount of redirection. We're in large school districts in most of South Florida, so we have very large districts that have a wide range of program placement options.
What happens when you have a child who also has a behavioral problem and they may be lashing out violently or doing anything that, you know, could be a disturbance to other children? How do they solve that problem?
The school system has or supposed to at that point, and again, I think parents who are knowledgeable also, you know, may bring this to the table, that the schools are supposed to do a functional assessment of behavior. So a careful analysis to understand why the behavior is occurring in the classroom, and is it happening across the whole school day or only in certain classes or only with certain teachers or only under certain kinds of assignments, to really understand the problem behavior. And then the team is supposed to develop a behavior intervention plan. If the plan is not working, the team should reconvene to see what changes are needed.
You know, it was interesting. One of the things in this book we were reading, Mothers of Sparta, Don Davies' son, was facing a lot of different challenges. And as he grew older, one of the challenges he faced was he would be on the internet and he would be looking at very disturbing images. When you find a student who perhaps acts out like that, I mean, is it about having constant supervision or just keeping them away from the thing that may get them in trouble?
It depends on what the behavior is. I mean, sometimes if we can environmentally arrange the circumstance so that they're not presented with that challenge, you know, it would depend on, like, access to the internet would probably depend on, is that necessary for them to complete their schoolwork?
Right.
You know, if it's not, maybe we would consider not making it available or putting in certain safeguards so they couldn't access certain sites. Obviously, schools do that in general, but there might need to be some special considerations.
When you talk about students on the spectrum who are capable of learning and you know, have an opportunity to grow up and perhaps have somewhat of a, you know, a normal adult life, what does the data show us about, you know, having those children in specialized courses compared to just keeping them in a classroom with their peers?
You know, I think for the success of people on the spectrum, it's not just about academic achievement. You know, we see most adults on the spectrum, including those who have a lot of language, maybe average or above intellect, is having a number of struggles as they move into adulthood because they have, you know, they often need a lot of instruction in executive functioning, in social thinking, in social behaviors.
You mentioned it a couple of times there. So, you know, social type of skills. So is there training, is there teaching just for socialization?
Schools try to provide some of that, but many individuals with autism require ongoing instruction in that, whether they're also getting it at home, whether the parents might be privately paying for individual therapy to work on that, or a social skills group. You know, it's an ongoing need for many people on the spectrum.
What happens to a child once they're 18, you know, but they still need assistance? Are there programs, state or federal programs, for that?
So if a child is in the public school system and they haven't met all the requirements for graduation, they're actually entitled to stay in school till 22. So special education is an entitlement, and they could stay in school and continue to work towards their graduation requirements, but also social skills and other kinds of skills. We usually encourage families to stay in school and utilize as much as they can get from the school system till the child's 22, if possible. And then once they turn 22, or say they graduate at 18 and leave the school system, the resources, it's more limited, because education provides a, you know, a huge chunk of what people on the spectrum get in terms of publicly funded services. They often qualify for some services from vocational rehabilitation, which can pay for a specialized training program like the Dan Marino campus that exists in Fort Lauderdale and Miami-Dade. They can pay for a technical school, and they can also help pay for college for those students on the spectrum. The funds from vocational rehabilitation are all focused on giving people with disability skills so that they can be competitively employed. If someone's already not pursuing higher ed, they contract with agencies to help place them or find them work, and they provide some limited job coaching. There's a range of things that can apply, but it's all focused with the idea of competitive employment.
That was Dr. Diane Adrian. She is with the University of Miami and Nova Southeastern University Center for Autism and Related Disabilities. We've been reading Mothers of Sparta by Fort Lauderdale author Dawn Davies. Join our Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Just ask to join. It's free. Still to come, the beautiful sound of the African-American spiritual.
Mandy Patinkin in concert.
Cats in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon.
The Tony and Emmy Award winner, who critics call a musical force of nature, star of Broadway's Evita, films The Princess Bride and Yentl, and the TV series Homeland, Mandy Patinkin presents his new concert, Diaries, at the Broward Center, February 12th. Tickets available at browardcenter.org and Ticketmaster.
Boy, 10-10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me?
Festival of the Arts Boca presents A Season of Heroes, February 28th through March 8th in Meisner Park. You can cheer Luke Skywalker in The Empire Strikes Back with live orchestra, thrill to the Cirque du Cinema, celebrate Beethoven's birthday, revel in the music of classical guitarist Milos and Miami's New Deco Ensemble, and party with Postmodern Jukebox, also political analyst Amy Walter, New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast, and more. FestivalBoca.org or 561-300-4138.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Take a really good story and blow it up a million times. Think everything being done in the grandest scale possible, as far as your imagination can go. That's how Keani Richardson defines opera. Richardson is a South Florida-based opera singer, and this weekend she'll be performing in a Black History Month music concert called Art of a Spiritual. She'll take the stage at the African Heritage Cultural Arts Center in Miami on Saturday. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
Why did you want to get into opera?
I began singing at the age of 2, and I grew up with music such as like Handel's Messiah all the way to classic Disney and Whitney Houston. So I had like this array of music that I would listen to, and my mother would actually put a cassette player at the head of the bed and she would play all of that while I would go to sleep. And it wasn't until around the age of 14, 15 years old that I was introduced to Phantom of the Opera. I bought the CD, I went to, I guess, Walmart or something, and I found the original London cast recording of it. I bought that, and then I bought another knockoff version of it, and I just became obsessed with it. And I was like, it was made off of a book, and I bought the book, and I read it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, opera's in this. And like, so composers like Meyerbeer, Gounod, and Handel, all of those people were reintroduced to me, and all of these great singers, and I'm like, I want to do this.
Is there something that said, you know, I want to perform this more than any of the others?
It did. If something about the grandeur and the oddity and at the same time the majesty of opera just captured my imagination and my attention. And I'm like, nobody in my family really does this. Everybody sings gospel and pop, but nobody really sings opera. And I'm like, I can do this. It was just like this encompass of like my imagination being blown to like a million.
How do you describe opera culture to someone who doesn't know? What is it?
It's basically if you take a really good story and you, like I say, you blow it up to about a million times than what it is written on piece of paper. That's basically how I view opera. It's everything on the grandest scale possible. Big music, big singing, the sets are outrageous. It's up to your imagination.
So. What misconceptions do people have about opera?
A fat woman singing with horns and with horns and the spear. I guess when you see me, you're just like, no.
which is where that is, that phrase, you know, when the fat lady sings,
it's all over. Yes.
That's what that is. How do you combat that, though? How do you combat that, you know, those misconceptions?
Right. It's gotten to the point now where I believe that it just belongs to everybody. It's not just to one particular class. It's really about the stories that are being told on stage is basically about you yourself.
You've also said you're taking the audience on a journey. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know what that means exactly, because how is opera like a journey?
It's starting from the first point of the story. So it's like you want to get to the end of the story. So at the beginning, you're introduced to these characters. And at least one or all of the characters you identify with. And through that storytelling and through that journey, you want to see if this character grows, if they stay the way they are, do they learn their lesson? Whatever is being told in that particular story, you just become part of them. Going back to Phantom, it's the same way. You are on this journey with Christine, and she is this very timid girl who is, you know, suffering from the fact that her father had died 3 years earlier. And you go through this story with her as she grows. You see the people who's around her. One person's pulling her this way, the other person's pulling her that way. But at the same time, she finally comes to a realization, like, you know what? I need to take charge of my life. And that's her story. That's her journey.
This weekend, you're going to be singing at a music concert called Art of a Spiritual. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So this concert is basically a performance where we singers present spirituals that tell the story of Black history. And oddly enough, it's actually going to be in Black History Month, since we're going to be kicking Black History Month off. And in this journey, we will be exploring how spirituals influence Black culture through perseverance, fight, and art.
You're going to be singing the song Right On, King Jesus.
Yes, I will.
Tell me a little bit about this.
Wow. So Right On, King Jesus was actually one of the first spirituals I actually got my hands on when I was learning about spirituals in college. And it's basically talking about the triumph of how no man can hinder Jesus. But at the same time, if we really look at it, it's was like kind of a synonymous thing for African Americans at the time to see that, you know, if nobody can hinder this figure, then nobody can really hinder ourselves either.
King Jesus, no man can hinder me. Ride on, King Jesus, ride on, no man can hinder me. For he is King of Kings, he is Lord of Lords. Jesus Christ, the first and last, no man works like him, for he is King of Kings, he is Lord of Lords. Jesus Christ, the first and last, no man works. works like him. King Jesus rides a milk white horse.
I'm talking with Kiani Richardson. She's a South Florida-based opera singer. She's also one of the featured singers at an upcoming Black History Month music concert called Art of a Spiritual. The concert will feature a group of 15 black opera singers from the region. The performance is Saturday, February 1st at 7 p.m. You can find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. The concert is highlighting what's called the African American spiritual. For those who don't know, how do you explain what that is?
I actually have a quote by Leontine Price that I found really interesting. The spiritual is the black heartbeat. It is a tapestry of life woven from our cares, suffering, fears, sorrows, triumph, beauty, and strength.
As you were growing up, how many of your friends shared that passion with you? How many enjoyed opera?
Because I want to know. It's funny you bring that up.
Yeah, because I want to know how do you introduce this to young people?
Oh, wow. So growing up, let me see. I'm going to have to dig back into my memory now. In high school, it was very, well, actually, no, let me go further back. Junior high, it was very, very odd to be introduced to quote-unquote opera or classical music. It was there, but it wasn't really like a thing at my school. It was more of like, oh, we sing musical theater and pop and all of whatever was the next best thing, like Backstreet Boys or NSYNC or Britney Spears, whoever, which I still listen to, by the way. I just love them. But for me, I don't know, just it was just something, like I said, it was just so different. It wasn't like anything else. And it was challenging. It was just gripping, especially when it was in the hands of an artist that really knew how to tell a story. And I just was like, I gotta figure out what this is. So I was introduced to the 24 Italian songs. It's like the Bible of this is how you get into opera. I did a project with Florida Grand Opera called Read Along, Sing a Song, and it's basically introducing young people to opera. So we would have to pick a story, and somehow I would have to find an aria to correlate with that story. So for Christmas, we did The Nutcracker, since I love that story. And I said, well, what opera aria can I do? And I said, Tales of Hoffman. That would work. The doll song from Olympia, because she's like this really, it's a mechanical doll singing this ridiculously high stratospheric singing. It also correlated with the Nutcracker because it's also like this whimsical, magical land. And the kids were like, oh my gosh, you can sing that high. And oh my gosh, I love this story. It just captures the imagination.
So you had the opportunity to you've performed in front of many different people, kids, but you also got to perform in front of the Obamas.
Yes, that was a really interesting point in my career. So many people know about the tragedy that happened in South Carolina.
That was the shooting at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Correct. And the following morning, I was in a car and we were riding to the space where we were going to be performing in this big arena. And I was looking around. I was like, there's a lot of people here for this thing. I didn't know how big it really was going to get. And I got into the space. I'm looking around at all these folks. And right when I was getting ready to sing with everyone in the ensemble and the little orchestra we had, I turned to my right and I see these like wall of them, like people in suits, and I'm like, who are these people? And someone was like, well, that's the House of Representatives. I'm like, huh? And then I happened to look down at the very front, and well, not the very front, but like towards the front, I see Reverend Jesse Jackson. Towards the back, I see Al Sharpton. And I'm like, well, these are like, you know, very prominent civil rights figures. Okay, still not clicking in my head. You can see how slow I am. I go to the front, and there is Hillary Clinton. And I'm like, uh-huh. And I go further and I'm like, there's the Bidens and the Obamas. I was blown away because I didn't realize that Reverend Pinckney was actually a senator. And it just hit me. I was like, okay, I'm a part of history that's happening right now. It's tragic that happened, but it was amazing to see how Charleston just came together and was just so supportive of one another. Mm-hmm.
Going back to your childhood, you think about all the different types, the genres of music that you grew up with. How did they influence your opera? Because I wonder, you know, if you talk to young people, you know, how would you inspire them and say to them, all this other stuff you're listening to, you can bring into opera. Everything interconnects.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. It just goes back to storytelling. I'll use the Backstreet Boys, for example, because this actually, I made this connection last year, funny enough. So the Backstreet Boys have already celebrated 25 years of being together. Congratulations, boys. And the way how each and every one of them started as a group, like as an individual to become a group, is really fascinating. But their music, they were able to tell a story through each of the songs that they were singing. And even so, more so now, like with their new CD, I can hear not only the growth in their voices, but the growth in the fact of their lives. Like, they're all fathers now. And I mean, they love to talk about their kids. They share that in their song. They talk about the lives and everything. Like one song in particular called No Place. They've been all around the world, but they really love being home with their family. So it goes back to storytelling and whatever they pulled from in regards to their travels. Like, oh, we have this Mexican flair, or we have like this German influence. It goes into their music, but you know, it still tells that story.
So, all right. So what advice do you give to that young person who, you know, they're they don't have the cassette player, but they're listening to music. They're listening to a lot of different things and they're trying to figure out what's that step for them, the next step for them and what direction they should go. Why would opera be a good place for them to go?
It's because it is different. It's because it's grander. It's because it just it makes you use your imagination on a more incredible level.
That is Kiani Richardson. She will be performing at a Black History Month music concert called Art of a Spiritual. It's this Saturday. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's our program for this Thursday, January 30th. Hey, don't forget, we got a book club. Find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Find out what we're reading for February. By the way, we're listening to No Place by the Backstreet Boys from their new album DNA. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday. No place, no place, no place, no place.